Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm La. So Avengers has finally arrived to Japan.
Finally.
Yay.
Wow. What was with that message you sent us, Chris?
What's that?
Are you guys going to see the Avengers?
Yeah, I was asking if you were going to go and planning to go and see the Avengers.
And then we're like, yeah, we are. And you're like, well, I was, but...
Share my pain, I guess.
Yeah, but why didn't you, like, ask us to go with you or something? Instead of just going, well, my wife can't go, so therefore I'm not going.
Oh. Yeah, I suppose it is a depressing message thinking about it back, huh?
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
Yeah, I thought that was a little bit depressing. I'm like, oh, you going to the Avengers? Yeah, maybe, huh? Because I'm not. Oh, sorry.
I was trying to continue the conversation and just, I guess, failed at it, so...
I was opening a dead-end conversation and decided not to close it.
Well, I'm trying to decide if Japan as a country doesn't like Marvel, because it didn't take Dark Knight any time at all to come from the States over here.
Oh, that's true, yeah. It actually beat Avengers.
Yeah. I mean, like, Avengers is what, like a 2.5 month delay?
Yeah.
Dark Knight was a couple days.
I'm sure there's, like, different... Well, sometimes they choose to have a worldwide release.
Yeah, some of the newer movies they're doing where they're releasing it worldwide first and then the U.S. afterwards to try and bump up the opening week numbers.
Did that with Battleship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
I wonder why.
People thought it was desperate.
Yeah. We did not go see that movie enough as a group to make that a viable option.
But we would have only bumped up the worldwide box office.
Oh, yeah.
We would have had to, like, take a plane to the States.
It wasn't a terrible movie, but it's not worth taking a plane to the States just to see it.
Yeah. Wayne and I are up to episode 9 in True Blood. That's really good. You got to start watching that, Chris.
I really do. I agree.
Yeah, you're not going to watch it.
No.
You just tell by that tone of voice. You really got to watch it. Yes, I do. All
right. Sounds like a plan, Lyle.
I am excited.
But we were talking at lunch. It seems that they're going to tie all the storylines together.
Well, except for...
Well,
one.
I mean, sorry, not all. Most of the storylines together, which I'm really liking, because kind of at least at the beginning of the season, you kind of had a bunch of...
Divergent storylines.
Yeah. You didn't really see where some of them were going to go, and some were obviously better than others, but I think it's kind of promising where everything's going to come back together, and you can see connections, and even if they don't throw the characters together, at least the storylines will intersect.
Mm-hmm. That's a novel idea.
All right. Hey, speaking of dead-end conversations, slam.
Glad to say I'm not alone.
That's pretty good. We were talking about, like, the pacing of some stories seems a bit odd, where they kind of end a little bit, like a few episodes short at the end of the season. So you have, like, a couple actors and you're, like, wondering what they're going to do for the rest of the season.
Be in the hospital, character-wise.
Oh, I guess so, yeah. So we're talking about Terry's storyline. That's not a spoiler.
Well, they've kind of done that before.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that storyline is over, and we still got 3 more episodes to go.
Yeah. So. That's probably the best season ever, though.
Yeah. Werewolves.
Yeah, I like the way that's going. Yeah. Yeah, we get to see werewolves have sex.
That did not sound creepy at all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Chris, come on, stop. Well, I guess the big news in gaming, other than, I guess, Gen Con, the other big news in gaming is the update... Or the new stuff for the D&D Next playtest. So, so despite me being a little bit of D&D Next.
Did out?
Yeah, out. Suffering a little fatigue there. I'm waiting for D&D Next, because I'm over D&D Next.
I think this is D&D Next 0.5.
Yeah, so we thought it's very topical, so we are going to discuss what's there and what's in it. And give our thoughts on it.
Yeah.
So... First thought, they gave us a lot more to work with this time.
So what did they give us?
They gave us the How to Play document, DM's guide, classes, races, specialties, how to create character, and a new bestiary. Sorry, and the new pregens. So that's about like 5 or 6 more documents than we had before.
With a few revisions to the How You Play and DM's guide, and of course with all of the different classes, races, backgrounds, specialties, etc., we can now build our own characters as well. So it's not just playing with pregens.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they did provide the pregens, but there are rules there to build your own character. And the overall How to Play rules haven't changed all that much.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And this is like a minor thing, but I guess one of the things I wish they had done was... On the document, highlight the rules or the sections that were changed. Because, like, if you want people to play sort of this new version and feel, you know, sort of feel out how it works, if the rule changes are small, they might be easy to miss, especially if you're just kind of assuming, well, it you know, this is the way things went before, so this is the way I'll kind of run it now. And unless you kind of go through the document with a fine-tooth comb, you may miss some of the smaller changes, which, I mean, if they want to see what those changes do, then it would have been helpful to, I guess, call greater attention to them.
Yeah, I was expecting, like when they release a new version of a program where they'll actually have, like, a list of all the things that have been changed, but not a big deal. It wasn't too hard to find.
So the big changes are surprise was changed back to the, quote-unquote, regular way, where, you know, you lose surprise, you lose the turn to act, as opposed to the initiative modifier they had done for the first version.
They also reduced the amount of hit points for both the monsters and for players. But healing went the same way. I guess people were complaining that they had too many hit points, that healing didn't feel like it was important enough.
Well, I don't know if people were complaining, but I do remember in a previous article by Mike Merles, and we even said this on a previous episode, that they were going to lower hit points overall to see if that made healing feel more effective. But sort of the implication I got from the article was, we're not doing this because people think hit points are too high. It was more, we're doing this because people are still telling us they're unhappy with healing. And just like, here's a tweak to see if this makes healing feel more useful. So the other big thing, or the other big change to the main rules was they brought back opportunity attacks. I guess some of the feedback, or a lot of the feedback they got after that first round was, we want to see opportunity attacks again. So those are now back in the rule set.
Yeah, it's really cool, because I always liked opportunity attacks. Thanks, I forgot about that one.
I don't know, I kind of have, I guess, mixed feelings about it, because one of the reasons for changing the turn structure to players only getting a move and an action was an attempt to try and speed things up. I heard Mike Merle say that one of the things that was slowing down the turns were minor actions, because certain classes and certain builds could do things with those minor actions, which would, you know, kind of prolong the turn, because people would have to shuffle through power cards or look at all the abilities or the effects they could do with a minor action. While other people who maybe only who had like fewer things they could do were A, either feeling like they were missing part of the turn because they didn't have a minor action, and B, trying to think of things they could do with that minor action so they didn't waste it. So both those things kind of factored into longer combat turns. And I heard him say that part of the reason they got rid of those sort of reactions and opportunity attacks in the first place was to try and cut down on the length of time a turn would take. So, I don't know, I wonder if this is a case of the audience or the fans really wanting something that goes against what the designers of the game would have done.
That's a good point. Because the opportunity attacks, the way they're presented, are a lot more limited than they were in third edition, for example. Because I think they're saying the only situation where an opportunity attack takes place is if you're trying to get out of somebody's threatened range.
Yeah, I was thinking that if you have a, like, what do they call it, a reaction?
Yeah, they call it a reaction, yeah.
Then it kind of does away with the, I guess, analysis paralysis of the minor action, and that there's a kind of a trigger. And if the you do it with the first thing that comes along that is a potential trigger, triggers it, then you don't have the person like kind of holding on to it or hemming and hawing about when to use it. So,
right.
Yeah, I can see it still being in keeping with their initial principles.
Okay. So you're suggesting it could be kind of like something from Magic where if the ability would trigger it, it does. Where you kind of wouldn't get to hold on to it and wait to trigger it later in the turn.
Right. It's not like Braveheart. Hold! No, they lift up this.
And then the English just say, hold on, look at those giant spears, turn and go the other way. And then Braveheart is screwed.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny. All right.
That's hilarious.
So hilarious. I'm silent and laughter.
Yeah.
So the big thing, of course, is that they release the character creation rules. Kind of the way you go through it is you do your ability scores, and then you choose four different templates that you apply to create your character. There's a race, class, background, and specialty. So I guess first up is ability scores. It's interesting because they've gone back to the old roll four dice and discard the lowest one method of creation.
Yeah, I saw some people really kind of complaining about that it's sort of broken because you could get like terrible scores and then your character won't be effective.
Oh, whatever. I mean, who doesn't re-roll one if you get a bunch of crap numbers?
And the other thing is they also provide a standard array for you to use right underneath that generating ability score line. So, plus, my thing is just hey, how about you just roll up a character again and again and again until you get 6 18s? That solves your problem. Because it is possible. Yeah.
That's what every 15-year-old does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I got all 18s. I rolled it at home.
I do like a point buy, though. But they're going to roll out a point buy.
Of course.
I mean, it's been the same with all the editions. It's like they say, well, you could roll it up this way. Oh, here's an alternative, the point buy.
Yeah, like, or your DM can tell you what system
you're
using.
Or you could choose one of these 10 different arrays. Yeah. I mean, that's what they're going to do.
Exactly.
I think just people like to complain.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Oh, and speaking of which, we're going to complain a little bit about D&D.
Yeah. Surprised you've been so quiet so far this episode. I expect you to be complaining all over it.
Yeah.
Hey, where's that soft snoring noise in the background, Lyle? Lyle?
I was against this episode, but...
I'm just kidding, man. I'm just kidding.
Well, as in a little aside, I think it's just the constant updates about nothing that have just kind of just bored me about D&D Next. It's sucked away all the thrill. So I was saying, I'm going to start something on the forum. It's going to be, I got 99 problems with D&D Next, but fucking the orc profile ain't one of them. You know? Just like...
Its hands aren't too big, really?
No, it's the gnoll. The gnoll picture ain't one of them. It's just like, there are things that we can talk about, but there's a lot of things that you don't need to talk about. And we're just as guilty as talking about these articles.
Because here we are talking about them.
And talking about them again. Anyway. Oh, yeah. Nope. But yeah, excited about this playtest.
And the Oscar goes to Lyle.
Yeah. In general, I'm not seeing a whole lot of new things, or some things are different, but nothing's
new,
radical.
You mean new in relationship to previous editions?
Yeah, it's looked like they've taken editions 1 to 3 and just trying to capture that and then just kind of thrown 4E under the bus.
Yeah. They did take a tiny little bit of 4E in that they kept like minor spells.
Yeah.
For the spellcasters. They're essentially at-will powers.
Right.
Even though they're not called that. So they did keep a little of that 4E. Mm-hmm.
And for that matter, though, the way the skills work is very similar to 4E. It's quite different from 3E, anyway. In that you choose a few as your specialty and you get a large bonus to those rather than like building them up slowly over a longer period.
Yeah, I would say with the backgrounds and the specialties, they're just trying to make it really, really easy for people to optimize their choices.
And it is, too.
So, but yeah, we're kind of getting a little derailed here. So after you roll up your abilities.
Well, since we're just cherry picking from previous editions, what do you do next? Yeah, you pick your race. And kind of no big surprises here. They've provided 4 races for us. Dwarf, elf, halfling, and human.
Mm-hmm.
There's 2 sub-races for each of the demi-humans.
And none for the humans. Oh.
Yep. Oh, and just like with the Orc and Null articles, they're the races from editions 1 through 4.
Yep. Well, I guess another thing they took in for 4, there's no disadvantages.
So yeah.
They get a +1 in a special ability, but they don't get a -1 in another one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say that that's gone too far in a way, but, you know, people just seem to complain whenever there's somehow a disadvantage to something.
I was going to say, I can swallow it a little bit easier because they've set a cap on ability scores of 20. You know, no ability score can go higher than 20. So, yes, it's not a disadvantage. You don't get any negatives to your ability scores based on the race you choose, but we don't have the ridiculously high numbers of 21, 22, 23, you know, that you could kind of get from 4E. So, yeah, it's not the same as a negative, but I can take it a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, I actually really liked the way that they put them together. Like, we were talking before about how a level system, every time you level up, it feels like, you know, you're opening a bag of treats or something. And that's kind of the way it felt with not only the races, but all the templates. Everything in it is positive. You just get more cool stuff that you get to slap on your sheet and build your character with. So, yeah, I liked it a lot.
So, like, speaking of getting things for choosing your race.
Damn, how about those humans?
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to think of a way to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
They get, like, massive boosts
to their abilities, +1, +2 in their favored yeah. one and plus one and everything else.
Yeah.
That reminded me of Prestige Clash in third edition. Something called the Destroyer or the Slayer or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he was against magic items. So he wasn't allowed to use any magic items or magic. But that was one of the things. They would get these constant bonuses to their abilities. I think it makes the math easier for humans because you just get it all at once.
Right.
And you don't have to worry about getting an extra skill point here or there.
Yeah, one of the few complaints I had about the whole character creation thing was the order that it was put in. Like, you rolled up your ability scores first, and then you had to write them down on the side, and then you chose your race and your class, which added bonuses to the numbers, but you hadn't actually assigned the numbers until after you chose the races, so it was a little bit confusing. You had to kind of go back and forth a lot, but I'm sure that'll be ironed out when they actually put it together in one book.
Well, I actually understand why they did that, because unlike previous editions, you get an ability bonus because of your race, and then you also get an ability bonus because of your class.
So, but what could,
I know what Chris is saying, but it's not as focused as 4E, but they still do say in the class, your important abilities will be X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So, if you're kind of going into it completely fresh.
Right.
With sort of no idea of what you're gonna play.
Right.
Generate your ability scores, then see where you're gonna put those bonuses based on race and class.
Okay.
And then tack them on to whatever important ability scores are. Yep. For your class.
But why can't you just roll your ability score just before you assign them? So you choose your race, choose your class, then roll up your ability scores and assign them.
I suppose there's no reason why you couldn't do it that way. Yeah.
The only reason why they have it is because that's the way they always did it.
Right.
Is you roll up your ability scores and then you kind of assign them. And now what they're saying is assign them later.
Right.
Which makes sense. But you're like, well, you're kind of like holding on to the step one from before, which doesn't really make sense.
But that's how I like to build characters often. I roll up the ability scores first and then kind of see where the bigger numbers are and then build something around those numbers. Try and match up the class and race to that.
But you can shuffle them around.
Oh, yeah, and I do.
Now, I think you brought up a really good point. Like, it's a holdover from Zero or First Edition where you did not get to shuffle your ability scores and you rolled them in order.
Yeah.
Where then it was, okay, I generate my ability scores. Let's see what I can play based on what I get.
Yeah.
Back when you had to do them all in order, you had to throw out a lot of characters because you're like, oh, I get to be a gnome illusionist.
I did that.
I know, which is why I brought it up.
Oh, yeah. That's back when the Dungeon Master made me roll in front of him. So I was like, probably the one thing I didn't want to play was an illusionist. And one race I didn't want to play was a gnome. So I rolled it up and he goes, yeah, that looks like a gnome illusionist. I'm like, great. It's going to be a fun game. Or when you have an idea, you want to be a swashbuckler and you roll it up and they're not letting you swap things and you're like, great, you know, my highest stat is 13, I can't do anything.
Well,
and
highest stat is 13, that's
It was some pretty bad rolling.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, yeah, so just role play through it. And you're like, whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, they could say, come up with a concept, choose your race and class as one step, and then assign ability scores rather than the way they've done it. So... Mm-hmm. After saying that, they probably did it that way just because it is, quote-unquote, tradition.
Yeah. So, and then they also have, I guess, the new thing is, well, it's an old thing by a new name. You choose your background and your specialty, but really you're just choosing your cluster of feats and your cluster of skills by choosing your background and your specialty.
Yeah.
So background could be...
Artisan, bounty hunter.
Yeah, thug, soldier, yeah. Noble, charlatan, things like that.
And specialty can be slayer. I can see why they did that. I mean, it does make it easier to quickly build your class. Slightly more quickly. You know, I want to play a knight. All right, I'll pick that. But you just know that they're going to come up with the list of feats and the list of skills as well, so you can customize your character. So, yeah, I don't mind it, but I don't see it as a terribly revolutionary addition to the game. It's kind of just it was like the builds that they have in 4E. They even had those quasi-builds in 3rd edition. Forget if they call them builds or not, but they basically, we'll plan out your class, especially with the multi-classing rules at the time. We'll say, hey, here's how to make a raider, a Viking raider. You know, you just got rogue and barbarian, show you how to stack and what feats to pick. And I was like, those are really helpful. Yeah.
No, but actually, I really like the specialty things. I totally agree, Lyle. I don't think it's a huge leap forward in innovation as far as, D&D goes, but the way you can tack on your backgrounds and specialties, and they are grouped together with like a nice little title to them. After you've chosen all the templates, like you already have an idea in your mind of like what the character could be, what their personality might be. I mean, of course you can go into it trying to build your concept, but I like to start from the numbers and then add on, the things from there and then kind of build the character out of what the mechanics are giving me.
Yeah.
But one also thing that I noticed about the specialties is that there was no rules limiting which specialty you could choose for it. So I'm wondering if that's some kind of a multiclassing thing.
I hope not, because when they try to get too clever with the multiclassing, like 4E, I think it just breaks. I think I think in 3.5 or third edition as well, they really hit upon like a really easy way to multiclass. And you just put them both together.
Yeah.
And I think they really emphasize it a lot, especially when third edition first rolled out. I mean, they were pretty proud of that system because every Dragon magazine would show different multi-class builds. You know, when the Oriental Adventures Dragon magazine comes out, they show you how to do all these different cool Asian-flavored characters. And I loved it. And I would really like to see them just to bring that back.
Mm.
And they can do all their suggestions and that. But yeah, no, I agree, Chris. I mean, it does make it easier, and it makes it easier for somebody to grab quickly a concept. And yeah, to mix and match, you know, a little bit, you know, if people want to do that. I think Wayne was saying that somebody made a fighter and took one of the more traditional magic user.
Yeah, like, I guess I was a little excited by the specialties, because two of the specialties allow you to get a little bit of divine spellcasting or a little bit of arcane spellcasting. And as Chris said, there doesn't seem to be any requirements on which class can take which specialty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of them have a requirement. Like, both of the spellcasting ones, you had to have a wisdom or an intelligence of 11. But so long as you had that, it seemed like any class could take these sort of, you know, any of these specialties. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, that's cool, because now you can give your fighter or your rogue a little bit of, you know, arcane magic. Or you can give them a little bit of, you know, divine spellcasting. And it's not multi-classing as previous editions were, but it's, yeah, just kind of like a different way to, or it's a way to make your character a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they will come out with multi-classing rules, because I may be jumping ahead a little bit here, but in the class document, the sort of the first line of every class says, if cleric is your first class, or, you know, if the fighter is your first class, then you get these bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
So they're implying if you multi-class into fighter or wizard or rogue or whatever, you will not get some of these bonuses. We don't know what the bonuses are. We don't know how multiclassing will work. There's no multiclassing feat yet, but they do seem to be setting themselves up for some kind of multiclassing rules. Will they be as good as, you know, 3E?
Probably not.
Because I liked those Dungeon magazines too. Like, yeah, probably won't do it the same way, but yeah, I remember when we were playing 3E, Lyle, you lent me that Dragon magazine, and it was everything of like, here's Barbarian class. And here's how you can mix it with every other class to generate this sort of whatever else you want. And that was really cool.
Yeah, actually, I agree with that. I actually didn't notice that line at the top of the class saying that you could move if this is your first class. But it's relieving to hear, because I was a little bit worried with the specialties. If you treated it as a multi-class thing, once you choose your specialty, that kind of locks in your feat progression for at least the levels that they showed there. So it'd be kind of weird. I made one cleric, and I took a fighter, the guardian, specialties aside, so I could kind of like protect characters around me. But I figured, like, doing that, then I wouldn't be able to take any clerical feats on the side. But again, I noticed that a few of the feats, they had notes on the bottom of them, like, you can take this feat multiple times, which implies that you'll be able to take the feats individually later on.
Yeah, again, that's what I'm wondering. As Lyle said, like, I'm sure we will see these abilities chopped apart so you can cherry pick which ones you want.
Mm.
But yeah. I don't know. You kind of have like the two sides of the same coin, or one way is easier. You just pick something at first level, and then based on that choice, you get extra abilities as you progress in levels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to sort of make any other choices. Oh, now at third level, I get this feat. Oh, now at fifth level, I get this feat. But, I don't know, like, what if you get something like, I don't like that one? You know, are they going to give you the ability to pick a different feat, or?
What if, I mean, we're looking at, it's a background and specialties go up to fifth level. What if they break it up and you can get backgrounds and specialties? And I know background maybe might not be the best word, considering it implies that something's happened prior to your character creation. But you get them in like 5-level chunks. Once you become 6th level, you pick a new one.
Oh, pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. I mean, so it could be something similar. So you could, let's say you chose the background knight, then you could take knight protector and then come 6th level, or champion knight or something like that. But or you could choose something entirely different. Let's say the knight progresses to
noble.
Well, you could pick noble, but maybe there should be the ability to enter into, like, the sixth level noble, you know, lord.
Oh, that's sorry. That's what I was suggesting. Like, I wasn't suggesting that you then have to take noble at first level.
Yeah.
It would be, no, now I get this fifth through, or sixth through tenth level noble option.
Yeah, yeah, whatever we want to call that. Yeah.
Extreme noble.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, I don't know, because I can definitely see the danger of, yeah, you do get kind of locked in, and they might, because feats and skills, they were a way that to specialize or individualize your character. And it was something that they, you know, they had in third and 3.5 and they liked, so they carried it over to the fourth edition. And I don't think a lot of people were complaining about that. I think people might have complained that, and we're kind of jumping the gun here, but maybe the economics of it, in that they were kind of relying too much on books with feats and skills to sell. Like, you know, instead of producing other types of books, they were producing these, like, rule books.
Right. Yeah. Right.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that later in the episode. So, yeah, there's a lot they can do with it, but I looked at it and I thought, yeah, that can make it easier, but, yeah, they are definitely going to come up with a list of feats and skills so you can customize right from the get-go.
Right.
And I'm not unhappy about that. I'm just like, oh, okay, I've kind of seen this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As you said, it's kind of something we've already seen before in a different wrapping.
Yeah. And speaking of things that we've seen before, like, you look at the races and I can't complain about what I saw. It's just... And there's a dwarf, and there's an elf, and Wayne was going, and there's a Caucasian elf. There's a Caucasian dwarf.
Well,
there's a Caucasian halfling.
Yeah, I guess slight tangent here, right? Like, if the hobby's looking to expand its fan base, right, its potential customers, then I guess the traditional market is the Caucasian male, right? So why not build in these demi-human races of other ethnicities that other players would identify? Like, reading through the races as they were presented, it said, you know, all elves are pale skin with dark hair. All dwarves are kind of ruddy. Or no, I believe they said tan, and all halflings are ruddy. You know? Why is it only humans that are the everything race? And I'm not really complaining per se. I just kind of see this as, I guess, essentially a missed opportunity. You know? You want to grow the hobby. Hey, try and have all the races appeal to a wider customer base. And that might, you know, that will bring in new money into the hobby.
Well, yeah, I mean, they try to play off humans as the most variable, and they say they go through the whole range of things. But they say dwarves also, they go from like a tan to a light brown color. So there is some ethnic variation. I reckon they just stay out of it for political reasons.
Wayne did mention, he's like, why don't they have like subclasses of human? And I said, well, you know that's just going to blow up in their face.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, the kind of Asian-looking ones are very smart, very good at math.
Yeah, right.
Can't say L's and R's. No, I guess I was more... That is a very good point. And I don't think anyone would argue against that. I was just saying, why are the humans always the multicultural race?
Because we're human.
But, yeah, but why can't the other demi-human races also be... or have that kind of breadth of multicultural ability, culture.
Because imagine how many books you would have to write in order to get to cover those cultures. But, we already know about human cultures.
Yeah, well...
I know what Wayne's saying. Let's say, for example, there's an Arabian subgroup of elves. You know, we were talking in a non-D&D fantasy episode, right. And we were talking about Cronopia, and how they kind of did that, where they made the orcs and the trolls and that army, they made them very... Arabian, we'll say, or Persian.
Yeah, Persian, yeah.
So, yeah, why not do that with the elves and that? And you know, like, despite the best of intentions, and no matter how well they write it, you know, people are going to complain because they're not elves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've kind of accepted that you can have black evil elves that worship spiders now, and they'll allow that deviation from Tolkien. But you know, once they make put an elf in a turban, you know, people are going to complain.
I'm not disagreeing. Like,
or, you know, there was a Chainmail was a miniature role-playing game, which was actually the precursor to D&D, and then they brought it back in third edition. And it's actually pretty good, and I think they're trying to bring it something similar back now, where they have, like, little war bands.
Dungeon Command thing.
Yes.
Which apparently doesn't use dice at all.
Yeah. But they had the dwarves, and they were kind of this communist Roman legionaries. It was a pretty cool army, because they had like little javelins and stuff, and they're ex-slaves, and they've kind of like formed this like very socialist society.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they look kind of cool, and you're like, you kind of change it. I mean, Romans are still white. But the fact that they shifted it a little bit, and you're like, I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought those were pretty cool dwarves. So I personally wish they would do more with that.
Right.
I agree with you. But, man, people just like to hate.
I agree.
Yeah, the nerd rage just wouldn't be worth it.
But I think they could have it in the core book where you have your Caucasian elves, and then when they come up with the new Al-Qadim or whatever.
Al-Qadim next. Yeah, I was thinking that.
Then they can have it where they have like the sub-race of elf. That would be great to see that maybe they're from kind of like in some African culture, or they're from some Aztec culture or something like that, something different. And I think that would be fantastic.
I agree.
They certainly have left the door open for that, you know, because one thing they do say in these documents are things like whenever you're given a number of options, like the number of sub-races for a demi-human race, they say, we've presented two of them here.
Yeah.
Kind of setting themselves up for the fact that there will be more, because we all know there will be.
When a big fall with halflings, when they just run out of ideas.
Seems like they already did. What was it, the stout halflings and the short halflings?
Let's see. We've broken down halflings into the two things they like to do: eat and be sneaky.
Yeah,
that's it. All right.
They're gonna come up with the feral ones.
Or the Dragonlance.
Riding dog ones, something like that.
Yeah. Last point on this, they always make a point of saying that adventurers of any race break the mold of the culture they come from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I get, right? Because you always kind of have this idea that your adventurer is an exceptional member of whatever race or whatever culture they're from.
I'm quick to laugh.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not slow to laugh. I'm quick to laugh. You're not and I have no beard. Oh,
I trust everyone.
Yeah.
I'm a hobbit and I'm a jerk.
Yeah. Wait. A hobbit who doesn't steal? Unconceivable. But I guess my point is, like, if that's always there.
Yeah.
Why?
You know why.
Codify those races, you know?
Why ask these questions?
I don't know. Because I like to stir the pot, all right?
Answer your own question.
Because they're lazy, and that's the way
it works. No, it's not because they're lazy.
I answered the question. It's not my fault you don't like my answer.
They do that so people have something to hold on to, and then people go,
exactly.
Yep, that's a dwarf.
Yep.
That's right.
And they're trying to bring new people into the hobby, so they need to define it for anyone who's new that they catch.
Yeah, what are they going to do? It's like an elf, and it's like a Vulcan? Sure. If that's what you want to play, it's like
a
Vulcan.
Hey, they at least had black Vulcans, all right?
In the original series?
Not in the original.
Yeah.
They did end up with them. And they weren't all evil. They weren't the drow Vulcans either.
And they worship spiders.
Yeah, exactly. Whoa, who let that on the Enterprise?
Yo, I'm not one of them kind of Vulcans. You can't just have like a blank slate, and it's like, well, it's a dwarf, and what's a dwarf? Whatever you want it to be.
It's like, the apocalypse world of D&D, huh?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, all right, ask these questions.
Yeah,
dwarf,
that's
what
how
do you think?
End up with duck people. I'll love to RuneQuest, but geez, duck people.
Yeah. Like, it's like grabbing air. Trying to grab these kids. So come on, obviously they're going to have to give you something to hold on to, but yeah, they're going to say, but you can deviate.
Of course.
Yeah.
So I guess in this one, humans are, whoa, look at those stats. That must be a human.
Yeah, everybody's like, do you know Conan? How would you like to just be Conan?
Yeah.
Well, it kind of explains why the humans have conquered the world.
Actually, it does.
Yeah.
It does.
They're just better.
Because they've kind of stuck with the, dwarves once had these great mountain kingdoms, and now they don't. And, like, elves used to be these, like, masses of magic and everything, and now they're not.
Yeah,
you know,
they used to be the smartest people in the world until the dumbest human farmer is the smartest.
Let's say I got 17 intelligence. It helps me plow.
So
you know, your dumb farmer voice sounds a lot like Bill Murray.
Going for a Cornish.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. As apparently, I probably heard the story. David Prowse, the guy that played Darth Vader.
Mm-hmm.
But the joke was because of his Cornish accent that the cast or the crew would call him Darth Farmer.
Well, you know, I'm horse. Darth Vader.
Darth Vader, the Force is strong in you. Yeah. Oh, Luke, I'm your father.
Sorry, what? You said that you're my farmer? No, I mean,
You're a farmer?
No!
good.
Sorry. Yeah, well, that's the races. What about the classes? What'd you think of them?
Again, kind of as we said about the races, there's not really all that much new here. They've, at least with the fighter, they've sort of fleshed out that combat expertise die mechanic a bit more. Like, we actually see the maneuvers that they can do. Mm-hmm. And it's okay, but it feels, and I'm sure it is, it feels very much like a first draft playtest. You know, like, it doesn't really feel like it's been tested. And this is speculation because, I don't know, like one of the abilities, right, allows you to spend a die if you miss, but still roll a 10. And you can still roll that die and do a little bit of damage. But, like, I calculated it out, and there's only one monster in the provided bestiary that really makes that ability any good. Because if you have a high attack bonus, like a good fighter will, a lower armor class monster, you're not going to miss. You're not going to miss and still get a 10 or higher to use that ability. There's only one monster provided in this bestiary where you get to use that ability against it. So it kind of gets back to the, didn't you test this and didn't you try this out and say, oh, wait, this kind of isn't all that great. I don't know, it kind of feels very odd.
Well, no, I mean, I didn't really have a response to that. I mean, you're right about that. It's exactly what we talked about when they said it on the blog post. It looks like a fine addition as a gaming mechanic. And the ones they have, I didn't notice that thing about the glancing blow with the roll 10 or higher, that how useless it actually is. But the different powers that they offer there, they all look pretty interesting and pretty fun. I'd like to play a fighter using these. But yeah, it does, just like we said, it does feel a little bit tacked on. It doesn't feel very naturally D&D. But I was looking through some other stuff, and I completely forgot about it. In Eberron, the old campaign setting, they had something really similar. It was the action point, which allowed you to get an extra D6 to add on to damage or your hit roll and such. That maybe that they're just sourcing that for this.
Oh, they might be. And I was talking a while before the podcast where some class features that other classes have, such as the cleric's channel divinity or the rogue's sneak attack damage, lend themselves to a similar die pool mechanic like the fighter's combat expertise die.
Yes.
Right? You could be able to, like, you know, you're gain multiple dice as you gain levels. You can either spend those dice to get extra effects or to do things. And I was thinking, rather than name them separate things for every class, you know, sort of partitioning them off, why not sort of turn an eye towards multiclassing and name them all the same thing, but just allow each class to use them differently?
Oh, I'm so happy you said that, Wayne. I had the exact same thought, but I thought it was going to be too nitpicky of me to actually say it. But yes, I totally agree. I think that titling it Combat Dice takes away from the mechanic instead of giving it a better name. Like, I agree.
I was trying to think of a name. It could be like Power Dice, right? Or like Stunt Dice or something. And every class could, you know, get a certain number of Stunt Dice. And then, yeah, if you do multi-class, you know, Fighter and Rogue, you can be able to use the Stunt Dice will stack. You could have access to some fighter abilities and sneak attack damage too, if that's all they get. But, you know, you wouldn't be as good as a pure fighter or a pure rogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, currently the only class who doesn't have something similar to that or something that would work very easy for that is the wizard. But I'm sure there are options you could come up with, such as, you know, expending dice to just add damage to a spell or to a hit, or to, you know, increase the DC save of your spell attack, or sort of getting to refill a spell slot without having to take an extended rest. So there are things they can do with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd like to see them do more with it, but someone I was talking to on Twitter had a good point, and they kind of said, that's not what I think of when I think of D&D, right? Like, I don't think of a die pool sort of mechanic resource game. I think of something else, which I guess is a good point, you know, as we're saying, they're trying to sort of recapture the market. If the mechanics deviate too far, will people still call it D&D, or will we have the giant outcry again like we did in 4th edition came out.
Yeah, but I don't think it was that 4th edition was different mechanics that disappointed a lot of people. It's the mechanics themselves that did it. I don't think it would have as negative an effect as long as it was a good, smooth working mechanic.
Okay. What did you think of the bonuses, like the weapon bonus and the magic bonus?
Kind of felt like 3rd edition.
It kind of felt like, man, they really don't want players to make a bad character.
Well, that too, yeah.
Damn, you're going to hit now.
Whether you want to or not.
Yeah, you're going to hit.
Am I roll a die? Do I hit? Yes. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, which I don't have a problem with. It's whatever.
But it does help with the feeling that when you play a first level character and you don't feel like you're any better than the average farmer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially like you play a fighter or something like that and you can't hit anything.
Or you play a fight and you're like, hold on, wait, that peasant could clean my clock with his pointed stick? Yeah. What's going on?
I wonder how balanced it is, because the cleric gets +2/+2. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it is.
Instead of like +1/+1.
At least in the 1-5 progression that we currently have, the numbers don't change a lot, though.
Yeah.
Like the fighter gets like +3/+3/+3/+4 at 4th level and then +4 at 5th. So it's not... It's not like the rapid advancement we saw for certain classes from like 3.
Yeah.
And it also kind of, when I saw that, I'm wondering if they're going to do what 3rd edition did and eventually split it where, hey, and now you get a second attack at a lower bonus.
I wondered about that too, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you get up to like +4, you just start getting like ridiculously high numbers where you hit on anything but a 1 on the d20.
For one of the sample characters I rolled up, I got a natural 18 for strength, so I put that into a fighter.
Sure you did.
Yeah, right. I knew that was coming.
How many times did you roll that?
Any witnesses there?
Right. But I ended up with like a 21 in the strength. Of course, I had to take it back on 20, but still, with all the bonuses added together, I have +8 to hit. Pretty nice for first level, but yeah, it's going to be hard to miss.
Well, you could get that even with the standard array. I mean, this is getting a little crunchy, but I mean, you take the 15, mm-hmm. which is the highest from the standard array, you'd pick a human, you get the +2 in the favored ability, mm-hmm. and then your class gives you +1. Boom, you're 18 right there, yeah. Which gives you like a +8 to hit right there on first level.
Yeah. And if you take the Slayer one, you can get an additional +1 bonus to certain weapons, and yeah, you're all set.
Yeah, there you go.
So you can still munchkin it. Oot.
Yeah. But I guess that does kind of raise a question, Lyle, like, should players be able to make a bad character if they want to?
Yeah, I don't see much point in that. Like, what's the point of making a bad character?
Mm.
As an experiment to see if you can piss off the other players around you.
If you don't actually want the guy to play with you, you can be a gnome illusionist.
I mean, you got to be good at something or you're not going to have fun.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
But I think they're almost making it where you can't have any drawbacks. That's why I like point buys. It's very much a balancing system. Mm-hmm. And I like when they have like disadvantages that are actual disadvantages, right. Or drawbacks that are actual drawbacks, or so you can buy more merits or advantages.
Yeah, kind of things that can't be munchkined.
Yeah.
One of the things I noticed, speaking to that point, is I tried to make one character that was more of a social character for it, so I didn't take any of the subclasses built towards combat, and I took a background that was all social skills, and I took jack-of-all-trades for the specialty. I have all of the social skills, and they have very high bonuses in them, but the guy can still fight pretty well. But, I mean, I suppose that's kind of one of the drawbacks of a template system, is that you can't really lose all your points in combat and then gain them in somewhere else, because you kind of get them automatically as part of the template.
Yeah.
But that said, I liked it better than 4th edition. Instead of just buying a couple social skills and then that was all you could do, this one you actually could give up some of the combat abilities in favor of having more social or skill-based things. So I did like that as an aspect of the game.
Yeah, like it does seem, at least in you know, the current rules, that you will be able to spread out your skills or you will be able to spread out your ability scores a little bit more than you could in 4th edition. What with Wizards saying they're sort of having this bounded accuracy where, you know, numbers are only going to vary a certain amount. Whereas kind of like in 4E, it seemed to be like if your primary stat was not a 20, you were going to be ineffective because you just were not going to be able to hit. Hopefully them lowering these to hit numbers and all these, you know, the monster math will allow you to say, okay, a 15 or a 16 in my primary stat is going to be good enough, meaning I can put the other things into, you know, other stats and have a slightly more rounded character if I want to. Or I can dump them all into one and be that combat or that, you know, to a lesser extent, social monster.
Mm-hmm. Social monster. Yeah.
Diplomacy!
He's devastating with his quips. an insult. Cuts me close. Yeah.
Wow, he just used a mocking strike on me. He's not even a bard.
Hey, dude, can you just shut up with the insults? You're not even playing that kind of character. You're not playing the social monster. Oh, yeah. But I just love insulting. Yeah, I know. But looking at, like, D&D Next, and they're spending a lot of time on the rules. And I suppose you would when you're doing a playtest. Of course, it's going to be with the rules. You're not going to really playtest the campaign setting, I suppose. But it got us to thinking is just how much of the problem is really with the rules? Like, could you say the success of second edition was because of the rules? And when there was kind of the glut and people got tired of D&D, was it because they were tired of the rules? Did people get captivated by Dungeons & Dragons because they were so captivated by this particular set of rules?
Look how many sizes wow. dice have.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say the same thing. That die is almost round.
Man, this Thaco makes this game. No Thaco, no game. And did people like not like 4E because of the rules so much? Or did a lot of it have to do with the presentation? You know, a lot of things came of this conversation. And I think two main things. One was kind of like the business model. And the other was campaign settings. Now, and they kind of go hand in hand. And just like, kind of, although I do like, I do think 3.5 is a superior set of rules to second edition. There was kind of an excitement with second edition D&D and with first edition D&D. For first edition was, they get rolling out all of these modules. Mm. And all of these modules will give you new monsters and sometimes
new settings.
Yeah, and a little insight into a new setting and or adding to a setting. Mm-hmm. And then second edition came around, and second edition, that was the campaign setting edition, and you would come up with a gorgeous box set after gorgeous box set. And yeah, you could say that they came out with too many worlds, but damn, what you get out of those box sets was really nice. Yeah. And that was really exciting to open up. And then 3 comes around, and everything starts to be built around the rules. And how excited did you get? Like, they came up with some great supplements, but a lot of it was, it's like, here's another rule book with more feats and more skills because they had nothing else. So you're like, who wants a 4,000 page rule book?
Right.
Which is what they were, you know, getting out. And then in fourth edition, who thought of this idea? It was like, yeah, when Forgotten Realms comes out, we're going to come out with two books for this campaign setting, the player's book and the campaign book. That's all you'll need. That's all there'll ever be. Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? The Hasbro guys must have been scratching their head going, how is that going to make us money? You know, milk that. That is something that you can milk. Don't milk these rules. It's like, oh, well, we're going to come up with 5 players' handbooks. And you think somebody might get sick of players' handbooks?
Yeah, right.
But no, because players love options. Players love options.
Yeah. Players are going to forget their options. And then, but you're only going to come up with like, we're capping it at 2. No one's really going to thank you. You know, the people that are going to complain that you come up with too many rule books aren't going to thank you because you only have 2 books for Forgotten Realms and 2 books for Dark Sun.
No, I was going to say, like, wild speculation here, but I imagine that it's easier to write rules than setting material.
I disagree. I'm sorry. The rules you have to balance, you have to test, you have to make sure that everything goes well. With setting, it's like writing fiction.
When you're starting a system from scratch, certainly. But, like, if you already have, like, the 4.0 rule set or D&D 3.5, right? Everything already works. You kind of know the system inside and out. Mm-hmm. So then you can just say, oh, what would happen if we did this, you know? Or, oh, let's come up with a new class. Hey, we have, you know, martial, divine, arcane leaders. Let's make a psionic one. And here's how it would work.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe part of the problem is that people hold on to their campaign settings. I certainly have. I still have Greyhawk from the Ashes, and I did buy the third edition Greyhawk, and it was good. Yeah, but certainly from the Ashes was better. But, I mean, that's easier to convert, and you got a lot of people, and they hold on to these box sets, and they last 30 years, and
yeah.
So they might be less inclined to buy the new Greyhawk setting. I know, actually, there was something, there was that Gary Gygax thing, that the problem they had with Gary Gygax, where they didn't want to pay him so many royalties, so they kind of de-emphasized Greyhawk, but that's another issue. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if they come up with like more, roll out more Dark Sun stuff, and it's like, well, people are only going to buy the actual crunchy stuff.
Right.
And then they'll use the old adventures and things like that. So there is that problem. I understand that. Yeah, you're just going to have to come up with some like really nice stuff. I mean, the Forgotten Realms core book that they came out with for third edition was gorgeous and very well done.
Maybe I'll modify my statement. Whether it's more or less difficult to write rules as opposed to fluff, I don't know.
I think they thought it was just easier to sell rules.
I think, because people think, maybe I'll say that instead. Yeah. Because, as you said, you're holding on to that Planescape book, or you're holding on to that whatever book, and the fluff if the fluff doesn't change, why would you want to change the fluff? You just need, oh, I need a rule that'll let me do this thing in the new system. Oh, yeah. And this one works pretty well. So, yeah, I think that's why Yisk came out with rule after rule after rule, or book, you know, all these books of rules. And
I wonder if maybe the rules of 3.5 were maybe too good for that, because the rules were so comprehensive. It allowed you to build nearly anything you wanted, from both player to NPC to monster, and then they had like a book of building entire kingdoms and things like that. It was so easy to make whatever you want that it became easy to convert all your old 2E stuff or create your own adventures. Back in second edition, it was so haphazard, you know, the numbers for the monsters, where did they derive those from? There weren't any formulas presented to players and GMs, so it might have been something.
Maybe another reason why kind of Wizards stepped away from the setting books for 3rd and 4th edition was their push of organized play. Because in my perspective, they really pushed that organized play, and they needed a standard setting that people would play in. Because the idea behind it is you could be a player anywhere and sort of play in any official, you know, organized play game anywhere across the world. Bring your character. You could go from like game to game to game all across the world. And if you built it from the material they said was being used, you could play anywhere. And I don't know. I don't really see multiple settings as helping that, because you're playing the same sort of adventure plot wherever you go. And it would kind of have to be a standardized world.
Mm.
You know, you're not going to go to one organized play game and play in Al-Kadim. And then the next game, go to a different one and play in like a Spelljammer game. No, it's going to be the same setting.
Yeah, true, true.
So, like, it may not be as big, but if people kind of say, well, like, why would I use this setting if I can't sort of play in it, I'd be less inclined to purchase it.
Yeah, I suppose, but how common is organized play?
I have no idea, because
it's hard to say.
I couldn't say.
Yeah, we've been in Japan for since it started big time.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, what I would hope to see is, nail down a basic set of rules and have like a decent plan to roll out more rules, but definitely do something with the campaign settings.
Yeah.
I'd rather buy like a nice box set with a bunch of supplement box sets that I don't really need, but I don't really need any of this. hold on. I don't need to do this.
You should have just seen the light bulb that went off over Lyle's head. Right.
I wasted my life.
His eyes just, all the blood drained from his face. Who am I?
He's like a born again all of a sudden. He's like, oh.
What could I have done? Oh, I could have bought a car with all that money.
oh, don't get me started on like the amount of money I would have in my pocket if I hadn't bought so much other stuff.
I could be rolling in women. I could just knock out
into. Because us RPG players are just being swarmed by girls.
Dude, I'm buff.
Not yet. You haven't let Magic Mike motivate you enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, actually, they might be setting themselves up to do that, too. Build more into settings and campaigns and such. Because, like, the backgrounds and the specialties, they really kind of match that thing. You know, if you have, say, your Al-Kadim setting, you can have a whole bunch of different kind of backgrounds that apply to a Persian setting.
I hope so. Like, I think that's exciting.
Hmm.
It's certainly much more exciting than a Player's Handbook 5 or 6. And you're just like,
yes.
Oh, Crystal Man, like, who cares? Like, how do I work you into my world? I don't.
Well, he's there. We just work him in.
Yeah, you can play a Minotaur now. Why?
Because It says I can. Here's the ninja class.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Here's the Minotaur race. By their existence, that means I can play a ninja Minotaur in your game.
Yeah.
No, you do realize we're playing like, Renaissance Europe. It's like, it doesn't matter. It's there. I can play it.
Player's Handbook 5.
So
something with that can make you really excited about that world, like coming up with like a core, none of this like setting and player's book, but like a core book. So everybody can, here you go. You just have to buy the one book for that setting. But you know something? Check out these other books. And they're going to be attractive. You know, there's going to be things in them that people, you know, a nice balance of crunch and fluff. And it's kind of rare these days to see like White Wolf's gone a little bit too much into the fluff.
Right.
But certainly some of the fluff that they're coming out with is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
If you can read it.
Yeah. If you don't mind reading like really weird fonts. Yeah.
There is hint of them possibly doing that, because the cleric will get to choose like a domain, which will be based on a god that they worship. And I believe Mike Merles has said that the different gods will change based on the setting.
Yeah, well, I hope so. You know, they come up with the core books. And the core books are like, hey, you want to house rule everything? Here you go.
Yeah.
And then focus on setting books and modules that add rules and ideas that, yeah, sure, maybe specific to that campaign, but still you don't mind playing. I mean, and then focus on maybe a few core before you get into the more esoteric games.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would much rather see a D&D Next setting box set than, yeah, Player's Handbook 5.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder, though, how much of this has to do with age. I'm speaking for myself here, but back in the second edition and early third edition days, I was in high school, and I loved just buying up modules and books and just even just sitting there and reading them on my own, like imagining what kind of games I could play with them. But now that I'm older, I think I much prefer creating my own campaigns and my own adventures to doing that. I don't know if it's maybe a sign of the times or if it's just me, but I don't think I would buy as much into campaign setting books as I would have when I was younger.
Why is that? You have less time now.
Yeah, I know. I know, but it's just, it's not a matter of time, though. It's a matter of what I enjoy doing now.
I thought you were going to go completely the other way and say, like, oh, I didn't care about the setting, so long as I can get that +8 attack and kill a lot of stuff real fast.
Mm-hmm. No, I always enjoyed reading setting books. Like, even to this day, I actually just like picking up gaming books and reading through them just to think about what I can make out of it. But I don't know, maybe it is just me.
Well, I guess it does kind of age, or not age, but sort of how people are approaching the hobby has possibly changed. And I think we touched on this in a previous episode, where people now, or at least new players coming in now, want to just kind of be able to pick up and put down the game and not invest a lot of time in it. You know, they show up for the game session with their character sheet. They say, you know, great, what are we doing this time? You know, they play the adventure or part of the adventure, and then they say, you know, great, see you next week, and that's all they'll really do. You know, where they just kind of want to, that chunk of time is for playing games, and the other chunk of time is for doing other stuff. And will those type of people buy a campaign box set, or will they kind of buy anything? Or does only the person running the game need a set of books, and that's it?
So. I don't know. There's always been that kind of player. There's the people nowadays who only like going on a raid the exact same as it would be in an MMORPG. But, you know, back in the day, there were always people who only played it for the dungeon crawl.
And back in the day, they played it the dungeon crawl to die, because those were adversarial GMs.
True. I don't know.
All right, so that wraps up our episode on D&D Next, the playtest. And I was promised that something non-D&D Next for the next episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I like how no one commented on my new word of Lyalogue.
Oh, that was fantastic.
I thought that was funny.
That was hilarious. That was good stuff. Yeah.
Lyalapalooza.
Yeah, that was so hilarious, no one even said, oh, that was funny.
Yeah. I said if it was on Facebook, I would have given that a like.
All right.
Yeah. All right, so next episode would be playing Magic Mike.
How many pluses does Joe Melangin and Benito's pecs have?
He's beyond human.
Yeah, where does that +2 stat go? Oh, charisma, of course.
All right, well, thank you for joining us on another episode of Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the website, download them through DriveThruRPG or on Stitcher or through iTunes. You can post on our forums or follow us on Twitter, through Facebook, or post right there on the website, or send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you. Thanks, and see you next time.
Bye.
All right, bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.